in the Shia school of thought and the Sunni school of thought, as well as the historians in the non-Muslim world who speak about Islamic history, we will find in all these texts, and we will find that it is unanimous and it is agreed upon, that in his time, Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most pious man, the man who had the most piety, who was God-conscious, who had taqwa. And so we find that in the lessons that have been given to us and handed down to us by Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, is this idea of taqwa, this idea of piety, this idea abstaining from the world, and more specifically, abstaining from loving the world, abstaining from being attached to the world. And so in one of these aspects, we find that Imam Ali, for example, he would fast during the days and he would worship during the nights, as even the Holy Quran makes a reference to those of Allah's servants who spend little of their nights in rest, or they spend a little of their night sleeping, for they spend a large part of their nights in the worship and in the remembrance and in the dhikr, the remembrance of Allah. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, he used to fast during the days, he used to worship during the nights. It is interesting, but you will see that Imam Ali, he would break his fast with dried barley bread. Now, first off, the bread being dry is a sign of this abstinence from the world. And not only was the bread dry, but it was bread made out of barley, as compared to wheat, right? And not only did he break his fast with this dried barley bread, but Imam Ali, it is related in the traditions and in the historical texts that he would keep this bread out of the reach of others, so that people around him, including his own sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, would not add any sort of butter or olive oil to this bread. You see, dear brothers and sisters, of course, this is a very ultimate and a very sublime, a very exalted form of abstinence from the world. Now, just before we end the session, it's important to know that this abstinence from the world does not mean that one shouldn't earn an income. We should make money, we should have good, strong positions, we should have a good status in life, our family should have a good status in life, but we should not be attached to these things to the extent where we don't need these things. But not needing these things does not mean that we don't go and earn an income. Of course, we should make money, we should earn income, we should be wealthy, but we should spend it in the way of Allah. A profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب
Oh Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. And I'd like to begin with this very question about Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the question about who is Ali is actually a very simple question. What I want to answer tonight is the question of what is Ali. There is a difference between who is Ali and what is Ali. You have individuals like Imam Fakhruddin Razi, a very famous mufassir of the Quran. He has a very extensive tafsir in about 20 volumes of, you know, bulky size. Right in the first volume, when he starts the tafsir of Surah Fatiha, he brings up this issue of Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Should we recite it in namaz loudly or silently? You know, among Sunni Muslims, there is a dispute. Some of them say it's not even to be recited. Some say you recite it was silently. Some say you recite it, you know, loudly. In the Shia Madhab, there is the emphasis that in every namaz, wherever you recite a surah, it is recommended even in Zuhr and Asr to recite the Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim loudly, even though you might you have to recite the remaining part of the surah silently. We emphasize in this point. Among Sunni Muslims, there is a confusion about it. Should you do it or should you not do it? And therefore, you'll see sometimes, you know, you will hear their namaz, Allahu Akbar, and there is this silence for a few seconds, and then Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Probably the Imam recited Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, but he decided to do it silently. This is where our sixth Imam says, you know, what has happened to the Muslims? They will recite everything loud except this beautiful ayat which talks about the rahmat of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam Fakhruddin Razi, in that tafsir, dedicates 3 pages on this issue, emphasizing that I believe that we must recite Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim loudly whenever we do the surah in the namaz. And what is his proof? He says, I don't care about what is the opinion of the Sahaba. He says, because when I study the life of Ali, I see that Ali used to insist to recite Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim loudly. And he says, for me, this is a sufficient proof. And so he goes against the majority there, and he says, I believe that the Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim should be recited loudly, because that was the insistence of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. And then he repeats that at the end, 2-3 times. Then my basis for this opinion is the tradition of Ali. And at the end he says, whoever follows the guidance of Ali is rightly guided. Why? He says, because the Prophet said, Aliyun ma'al haqq, wal haqqu ma'aliyin, اللهم عدر الحق مع علي حيثما دار.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
People around the world celebrate the changing seasons in different ways. In the U.S., an annual pumpkin contest is held to kick off the fall season. Each year, farmers and vegetable enthusiasts from across the U.S. gather in New England for the competition. Anyone bringing the largest homegrown pumpkin gets the prize. This year, a man from Abington, Connecticut, got the prize for his pumpkin weighing more than 2,000 pounds. Alex Noel explains how he worked hard to produce that giant pumpkin.
A nearly unlimited amount of work goes into producing a 2,000-pound-plus pumpkin. I put about 1,000 hours a season into 2 to 3 giant pumpkins, and you're lucky to even get that many by the end of the year. I'm out there watering, fertilizing, keeping excess water off if it's too rainy, which it was this year. Spraying insecticides, spraying fungicides, pruning, training vines, dropping up leaves at the end of the season, putting blankets on when it's cold out, heating cables, fans. I mean, the list goes on and on.
The New England Giant Pumpkin Weigh-Off began at the Topsfield Fair in 1984. That year, the winner showcased a pumpkin weighing 196 kilograms. The weigh-off has received worldwide recognition, too. Syria's ancient city of Aleppo seems getting a taste of normalcy amid reconstruction efforts in the war-ravaged city. A Syrian historian has also been contributing to make the city regain its lost glory. Ala al-Sayed is working to faithfully restore the lost sections of Aleppo's old city. For that, he is using documents and clippings he himself saved during the early years of the conflict. He says he came up with the idea to digitalize those documents in 2013. Then he embarked on organizing newspapers, books, and pamphlets while scanning each one to add to his digital library. Following the liberation of Aleppo, Ala came back to the city and started renovating historic places, which are on the World Heritage List.
North Dublin suburb of Howth has a new highly efficient firefighting crew. The group has 25 members, but none of them are human.
Howth was targeted by a lot of fire, and so there's a lot of gorse here, and it's prone, it's very flammable. The goats, on the other hand, love gorse, so it's a win-win in that sense. I suppose the project also focuses on the old Irish goat, defining their role as a functional biodiversity crew. They're a hard-working crew, they're up for the job, they're keen to do it. It also instills key conservation grazing principles to tackle fire prevention and habitat management and the control of invasive species. So it's the old Irish ladies that have a job to do here and are well able to do it.
The goats graze eagerly on the ample gorse bushes, which are highly inflammable and cause blazes in hot weather. The local council hopes their deployment will make Howth less susceptible to wildfires. Conservationists also hope that the project will contribute to the survival of the old Irish goats, which almost went extinct in the last century. Each member of the herd has a box around their neck with a built-in GPS device. If the goats stray too far, the gadget will ping and let the owner know.
Five Siberian tiger cubs born in a South Korean zoo have made their first public debut. The cubs were born at Everland Theme Park in Yongin in late June. Their birth brought joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts as they are listed as endangered species. Zookeepers say it's unusual for Siberian tigers to give birth to five babies at once. South Korean people selected the cubs' names through an online vote. Many exotic fruit plants need the tropical climate to grow, but Assyrian is producing nearly 100 types of tropical fruits at his backyard in a coastal city of Tartus. Mohammed Hassan's passion for agriculture is to the extent that he left his job in media to build a farm. He managed to create a tropical environment at his compound, and that was the reason behind his success in growing fruits that are rare in many parts of the world. In fact, he has turned his farm into what he likes to be described as a tropical cave.
I came across the world of tropical fruits as some of them existed here. Many immigrants also helped me on this path. They bought me special varieties from India, South America, the Caribbean and other countries, even China. Currently, we grow 93 types of fruits.
Hassan's success has encouraged other Tartus residents to create their own farms. The government is also assisting Hassan with his unique business. His farm is now open to tourists and visitors where they can taste the products. Hassan says he has bigger plans for the future and is thinking about using his tropical environment to raise and breed rainforest animals. In Brazil, paleontologists have discovered the fossilized remains of a dinosaur that lived roughly 70 million years ago.
It's a bipedal dinosaur with short arms, around 5 meters long, and it was at the top of the food chain in the period in which it lived. It was the predator at the time.
Paleontologists say the fossil suggests a dinosaur species known as Kurupi itata was a meat eater. They found the ancient predator's remains at one of Brazil's richest sites for dinosaur findings in the city of Sao Paulo. The first piece of Kurupi itata's fossil was unearthed during an excavation work in 2002. Until the completion of the research, a model of this species would be on display at Monte Alto's Museum of Paleontology. Experts believe the discovery would help scientists better understand paleontology on Brazilian lands. Most of us know the feeling of being moved by a work of art. A Kosovar artist tries to make us understand a political discourse through a mosaic of outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Alkent Pajogo has made a Merkel mosaic from seeds. The artist says he wished to thank the German leader for having been an example for all the women of the world. He says his work is also a tribute to the towering lady for the support she had given to his country, which declared its independence in 2008. Pajago was doing his work on the same day Germans were voting in the general elections to choose a successor to Merkel. Alkan Pajago holds two Guinness World Records for his giant mosaics made with seeds.
Technology plays an important role in our daily lives. This time, a French company has introduced a device to help the visually impaired to avoid obstacles. The smart electronic device detects obstacles and warns users with a beep. People with vision loss can install it on the top of their canes and receive information through headphones. The gadget helps people to dodge barriers on the ground and above that, for example, the open door of a truck.
If you hear the sound to the right, it means that the obstacle is on the right. If it is straight ahead, the obstacles are in front of you. So you change course according to what you hear. If you hear an obstacle to the left, you go to the right, and this way you can go around the obstacle.
The device costs around $2,300 and is now being used by hundreds of people in Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland.
Wally the Walrus has risen to fame with his extensive travels around Europe. Now the giant mammal has added Iceland to his list of trips. Wally has previously visited France, Spain and the UK. His last known location before Iceland was Ireland. Scientists were not sure at first if they had indeed seen Wally, but Seal Rescue Ireland recognized him from scars on his front flippers. The wandering walrus is 4 years old and weighs about a ton. He has covered a distance of around 5,000 kilometers in his recent trips. Wally is now on his way towards his home in the Arctic. A French zoo has had a very productive year, welcoming multiple new animals into its collection. Two pumas, two jaguars, nine Peruvian squirrel monkeys, and even rarer, macaque twins are new additions to Le Mignet Zoo this summer. The animals were bred as part of a program designed to maintain and promote the conservation of endangered species. Once they reach the breeding age, these animals will be transported to other zoos to help boost the population of their species.
Now, a museum in Russia's Kaliningrad has unveiled a special exhibition to the public. It would not be exactly wrong to call the artworks out of trash. All the works exhibited are made of rubbish. The exhibition is showcasing a wide array of objects, including sculptures, musical instruments, robots, and costumes. The project was designed with the aim of raising awareness about recycling. People visiting the exhibition were delighted by the creative use of garbage. Only 7% of waste is recycled in Russia each year, while a vast amount of trash is stored in landfills.
An Egyptian artist is making incredibly tiny statues of famous historical figures and landmarks on pencil tips. 30-year-old Ibrahim Balala is based in the city of Rashid, south of Cairo. He has mastered the art of crafting miniature sculptures. Ibrahim mostly creates statues of Egyptian pharaohs, but Islamic, Greek, and Roman figures also feature in his portfolio. the artist to receive some criticism when he first ventured on his art, but he persevered and rose to prominence with his minuscule statues. Ibrahim's dream is to open a museum of miniature sculptures someday.
Fourteen lucky penguins have been returned to the seas off the Atlantic coast of Argentina after rehabilitating them from malnutrition and hypothermia. The Magellanic penguins waddled back happily into the chilly waters once they were released. They were distressed, malnourished, and dehydrated when they were found by conservationists in February. There are an estimated 2 to 3 million Magellanic penguins in the world. The cute birds are named after Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. They are mostly found around Argentina and Chile.
Another groundbreaking archaeological discovery in Peru is now catching attention. 800-year-old human remains south of the capital, Lima, highlight the ancient burial rituals in the South American country. The remains of 8 adults and children buried in a common tomb were found by a group of workers laying gas pipes at the site. They were buried with food, dishes, and musical instruments, including flutes. Archaeologists say that the 8 people lived in the ancient town of Chitka, some 60 kilometers from Lima. They say some of the bodies were buried with the shells on their heads and had bags with cocoa leaves inside them. They say the discovery will shed more light on the pre-Hispanic history of the region. Another 30 human remains had been discovered in Chilca in 2018.
A taxi company in Thailand has turned its vehicles into mini vegetable gardens to help its drivers who are out of work due to the coronavirus pandemic.
The point of this project is so that employees have something to do to reduce stress. To a certain extent, it has helped with reducing our stress, but it isn't really the answer to the situation right now. Even though the drivers and the staff are able to harvest the vegetables for food, it's just part of solving the problem. I think the government should also step in to help us too.
The taxi company is growing vegetables on the roofs and hoods of 300 disused taxis that are parked idly. Prolonged COVID-19 lockdowns have affected the drivers' income negatively so that they are unable to pay the lease of their vehicles. Therefore, working in these gardens has reduced their stress and provided the drivers and their families with food. A group of Cambodian students has designed a manned drone in an attempt to beat traffic. The drone has 8 propellers and a school chair for the pilot's seat. It can carry a human weighing up to 60 kilograms. The creative students say the drone is still in its early stages of development and testing. Equipped with 4 batteries, the human carrier drone can fly up to 4 meters and around 10 minutes above the ground.
Here we have big problems related to traffic jams, so we did some research about this before building the drone. We came up with this drone project as we had the idea that we wanted to solve some problems for our society by making a drone taxi, as well as investing drones for firefighters to help put out fires.
The prototype has cost around $20,000 to build. The designers say they need 2 more years to complete the project. The school has expressed hope that the drone could be used in everyday life.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about Nazr, or giving food and charity to the poor and the like, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Giving Nazr and donation and charity is a common practice in many places, sure, especially among Muslims.
A lot of women also give food and charity to the poor. All right? In every month, sometimes, or even especially in the month of Muharram or in the month of Safar. This is done not only to commemorate these months and the martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, but also to earn rewards and thawab, right?
Yeah.
I want to ask you this question. Is it permissible for a woman to give a sadaqah, a charity, alms, or food to the poor, to those people who are deprived, basically, economically speaking, or financially in a bad way, or to the neighbors using her husband's money or wealth without the consciousness, without the awareness of the husband?
Good.
All right. So, is it permissible?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I would like to clarify the meaning of Nazr. You know, we use the word Nazr very often, and this word is used in different countries and in different Shia communities. Of course, when it comes to the Persian or, let's say, Indian Shia community, of course, the word Nazr means giving food to the poor or to the neighbor. But you know, Nazr, speaking from a legal perspective or from a juridical perspective,
yes,
I think first of all we need to know what Nazr means, and what is the exact word we can use in place of Nazr. See, I think the best word to use is the word vow. Okay.
Yes.
And now let's define vow. Okay.
Right.
Vow means making it obligatory upon oneself.
Right.
To do something, or to do something, or a good act, or to refrain from doing an act which is better not to do, or which is haram to do. Okay. For the sake of God or for the pleasure of Allah. So, the point is that vow means to make a good act obligatory upon oneself. Okay.
Yes.
This is what jurists understand from the word Nazr and the word vow. Okay.
It's a kind of promise, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a kind of promise. And let's use the word vow, because promise may be mistaken for ahd, for, let's say, some other.
It's much more general and broad.
Yeah, it's more
right?
general and more
broad.
Yeah, inclusive.
Yes.
And of course, there's another word which we may use the word covenant, but that's another word completely different. And surely.
Yes.
So Nazr used in by the Persian community or people who, especially ladies, who give food handout to people, and to the poor. That's a kind of mustahab charity given by women, or by people to the poor or to the neighbors. Okay. We, of course, can talk about that as well in this episode or in the following episodes.
Yes.
Anyhow, when it comes to your question, you just said whether it is, you asked whether it's permissible or not for a woman to give food or charity or something of monetary value to the poor, or to the needy, and to the neighbors, okay, for earning sawab, okay. Of course, it's very important, it's very recommended, highly recommended to give charity, to give food or money to the needy, because the Quran says, وَانْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ. Okay, you have to give charity from what you like, okay?
Yeah,
I like money, I like my wealth, I like whatever I have saved in my life. And anything which is of monetary value is what I like. Okay,
yes.
So it's good and recommended according to fiqh, according to the Quran and Islamic teachings, to give something in charity. But when it comes to a woman using her husband's property, wealth, or asset, or whatever, and savings to give charity, of course, there's no doubt as to the fact that she must get her husband's consent and permission. Explicit consent is important, of course. And without his consent, Of course, it's not permissible to give charity or to make a vow, you know.
Okay.
That vow can be nullified by the husband, okay? If the husband opposes the wife and tells, okay, you cannot do nazr because I need you, for example, you must be available for me. Okay, she cannot do nazr. Even if it is an obligatory nazr, mm-hmm. that nazr is not going to be binding.
Okay.
It's not going to be obligatory to comply with.
I see. Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back and discuss more of these laws.
Sure.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on Arab English Radio. We are still talking about vows or nazr, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. If Sheikh Javid, a person pledges a vow that he will do something, but he cannot or he does not recite the formula of the vow or nazr, all right? Is it still necessary that he fulfill the promise? Is just making the intention of the vow sufficient or adequate?
First of all, from what you just said, I understand that it is basically there is a formula that one has to recite,
mm-hmm.
because that that's what you your question implies. And of course, a formula is required, okay?
Yes.
And without a formula, the nazr is not going to be binding, okay? Now, when it comes to reciting the formula, of course, the nazr or the vow becomes actually obligatory and binding when, in fact, the person who wants to make that vow or pledges a vow
mm-hmm.
actually does recite the formula.
Right.
And if he just makes the intention or passes his intention through his mind without uttering anything,
mm-hmm.
so it will not be obligatory to comply with that intention.
Uh-huh.
Okay. He has to say something. He has to recite it verbally, recite the formula verbally. And it's not, the formula means there is a standard saying.
Mm-hmm.
There is a saying which one has to recite if he is willing or if he is planning to make a vow. And that formula must convey an explicit meaning, okay? The formula is a standard formula. It is okay. It begins, for example, if you want to recite the formula in Arabic, you have to recite, for example, لِلَّهِ عَلَيَّ أَنْ أَسُومْ or لِلَّهِ عَلَيَّ أَنْ أُصَلِّي. For example, it's from Allah upon me to, for example, offer prayer or observe fast. And then the vow that you make should be fixed. And of course, it should be clear enough, okay? Clear. You can make a vague vow, mm-hmm. okay?
Yes.
But in that case, if you make a vague vow and without fixing the time, without fixing the quality or the attributes of that vow, it will be binding, but it's not necessary to comply with the vow immediately. You can delay.
You can leave it open-ended.
Yeah, you can do it anytime.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun la ilaha illa hu ghaffarun jameel.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to your program, Heavenly Grief. Today we have our esteemed guest, Sheikh Muhammad from the Islamic Seminaries in the holy city of Qum. Today we're going to talk about the demise of the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, son of Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Sheikh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me and thank God for giving us this opportunity to talk about Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam.
Indeed, a great person, indeed a great honor to talk about him.
Yes.
Dear Sheikh, can you elaborate, can you talk about the livelihood of the Prophet? How did he live? What was his teachings?
Mm-hmm. Well, about the Prophet, talking about him is very difficult at first, since such a person and such a character in history cannot be described or cannot be talked about by people like me. But studying the history and especially narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam and also the narrations from the life of Rasulullah, it gives us a good and clear picture about a way that Rasulullah, the Holy Prophet, thought and the way that he wanted to live and to also preach this and to give us this way of life, this lifestyle. Well, the first important thing I reckon for paying attention to in the life of the Holy Prophet is the way he wanted to live. The way he wanted to think, you know, to kind of put it into a term, the lifestyle of the Prophet. I think what he has brought to us, the answer of these questions. You know, thinking about this, I think right now, because of the diverse and very different forms of lives that people have, you know, different types that people tend to live, and different persuasions they have, and different associations they have. It comes from within, like how they think and how they act. according to what they think. It is, I think, still up to now the most important and fundamental pillar of the life that people have. What we should do, how should I live, right? So we find different people with different religions in the world, like different ways of thought, different schools of thought. It's been constituted because of the fact that it's very complicated to live. We have different needs, we have various things to serve. So paying attention to that gives us an array of plans or ways to live. Since at first, you're not paying attention to the way that we are born. In the Quran, God declares that أَخْرَجَكُم مِّن بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْءٍ. It's very clear for us that when we were born, we didn't know anything about anything.
So
right?
This verse says that when we were born and we were given birth to from the wombs of our mothers,
yes,
we had no knowledge. We
yes
knew nothing.
And it is something very clear for us thinking about that. So we find ourselves not knowing anything. So we grow up, right? After that, one of the most important questions that comes to our minds and pops up is the fact that, okay, what do I do now? How do I live? And this question applies to every aspect of our lives. What do I eat? What do I wear? How do I act and behave towards my parents, towards my friends, towards the social areas and places and people there? What do I do? How do I buy? How do I get married? Right? How do I choose? How do I decide? These are the questions that come to the minds of wise people. And the answer of this question just opens a path for them to see the future and to understand how they should live, right? I think one of the most important teachings and the things that the Holy Prophet, as the last prophet and as the highest ranking prophet of God, has brought us is this lifestyle, right? Because thinking about this, we are too much uneducated and we don't have the knowledge. We are too much ignorant to know everything about the world and everything about ourselves. Even when thinking about ourselves, you know, take a look at yourself. How much of your body are you aware of? How much of that do you know? What happens there, the processes, you know, in your mind? How has it been created and how does it produce things? We don't know that, right?
Exactly.
Especially about the outer world, other people, other things, other phenomena. So this gives us the idea that since I don't know, God must have put a person or a source for us to go to consult and to understand how to live.
To teach us.
Yes.
To, like, in telling us how to live. We are ignorant. So you're saying that we are people as we are ignorant. We need guides, we need messengers, we need prophets.
Yes.
To show us how to reach the utmost and perfect image of ourselves.
Yes.
So that was a part of the mission of the prophet.
Absolutely.
Continue.
Yes. It was the part which just preaching and getting the message to people. I think there are two ways of living. You know, when you're thinking about, thinking and studying about the ideologies, different and diverse ideologies and doctrines that exist in the world and people live by, you understand that they all are, they all just come into these two ways. Either you worship yourself and you give respect, the utmost respect to yourself and revere yourself, or either, or you respect and worship God, right? In these two ways. So many ideologies, studying about that and learning about them, either they are human and self-centered, which we call that revering yourself, worshiping yourself, what I enjoy, what I love most, what I like, what is good for me. You know, so either this or no, I always prefer the satisfaction and the contentment
of
and the will of God,
God
over myself.
We will continue at this point. We will take a break and then we will meet you again with our dear guest, Sheikh Muhammad, in your program, Heavenly Griefs.
Oh.
Welcome back. We will continue where we left with our dear guest, Sheikh Muhammad.
Thank you very much. Well, previously we were talking about the different ideologies in the world and different lifestyles that we find in the world. And we talked about the fact that all of them are in one way just concluded in two different ways of living. Either we love ourselves the most and we are self-centered, or we revere somebody else, a higher cause and a higher call. We answer to a higher call. So the first one is the one that had been very rampant and spread, you know, among the world. The first one, you know, especially about the life of the Holy Prophet, studying the history before he was born in the time that they call it Jahiliyyatun,
the age of ignorance.
Yes, the age of ignorance for the Arabs.
Why did they call it the age of ignorance? Many people ask, why did they call it the age of ignorance?
Because when you study the ways that they thought and the ways that they acted, you understand that they were very much under even the lowest standards of humanity could be found in that area, let alone the standards of humanity that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have taught us. Well, for example, in that age of ignorance, you could find many people, many Arabic people, killing their own daughters, right? What is the meaning of that? When talking to them, in history it is narrated that they said daughters are not good. They didn't like daughters. And they are like a curse for us. They thought like this.
So they believed that if they had a daughter, it will be a curse for them.
Yes. So because of that,
amazing,
the father himself would bury the daughter under the ground while she was alive.
He would bury his own daughter.
Bury his own daughter. You know, think about this. How is it possible for a father to do such a thing? This actually tells us the level of understanding, the level of thoughts that they had. The level of ignorance.
Now it makes sense why they said the age of ignorance.
So, for instance, according to this, this is one of the matters that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, addressed and talked to them and said, the girls are born, when they are born, the sky just is over them and the earth is under them and their livelihood is on the hands of God. Why do you kill them? You don't think...
What did he mean with the skies is over them, the soil is under them, the earth is under them?
He meant to answer one of the reasons, or to answer one... Actually, after one of the reasons that they said, they were some of them were afraid to for the child, for the girl, to support the child, to give them livelihood.
They were afraid of poverty.
Afraid of poverty, actually, and also afraid of that made-up curse that they had in their minds. So the Holy Prophet said, why do you do this? God has completely guaranteed the livelihood of all of his servants, especially women. And also thinking about this, I am born because of my father and my mother, you know, both my mother has been just given birth to me. If my mother did not exist, then I would have not existed, right?
Exactly.
So this is one example that tells us the level of ignorance and the level of corruptedness that was happening in that society. So out of this society, the Holy Prophet rose to give us the highest and the most elevated teachings that God has ever sent to humanity. Think about that area and think about the job and the mission of the Prophet. How difficult is it? It's absolutely difficult, right? So what the Prophet brought to us is very important according to this fact, according to the fact that in that area, doing such deed proves to be very difficult, to be astonishing, hard. So what the Prophet did was just first to tell the people that the way of living is not just being self-centered. Because all of them just paid attention to themselves. Okay, what do I like to do? What is the best for me? What is most pleasurable for me? Right? And because of this, they did whatever they want.